Emma, good job. And all my worship leaders, good job, guys. Of course, I'm a bit verklempt now. All right, well, hello. As the Christian Education Coordinator and Youth Director of this church, it is my honor to speak to you today. It's a blessing to be here. This is a happy time for us in our church. It's the start of our religious education year for all ages, not just the little guys, but all the children of this church, all the children of God, who find themselves in this beautiful space. So happy kickoff Sunday to you all. When I was a little girl, I spent hours at my grandmother's house reading copies of her National Geographic and Reader's Digests. I don't remember much about the National Geographic, aside from some rather eye-opening photographs. But I do remember many of the stories I read in the Reader's Digest. One story, which is actually a bit of an urban legend, went something like this. A trucker was unfamiliar with an area, and he failed to notice a sign stating the clearance of the upcoming overpass. As the story goes, his truck got stuck, and nothing he did could get the truck free from the overpass. Traffic backed up, tempers flared, chaos ensued. It was worse than Highway 217 on a rainy Friday night when the Blazers are playing at home. So, of course, first came the police and then the Department of Transportation, and pretty soon all the best engineers and experts. They all got there, right? And each offered an idea of how to get the truck free without causing damage to the overpass. And, of course, each expert failed. All sorts of education and book smarts were gathered around that truck, and none of them could figure out the solution. Then a little boy came by to see what all the hullabaloo was about. In a few minutes, he shouted, "Why don't you just let the air out of the tires?" And of course, it worked. I share this story with you today as a reminder that many times the answer is much more simple than we think it will be. And I also share it because it reminds us that children are sometimes way smarter than we give them credit for. But I'd also like to remind you of this. We can all still be childlike in our approach to life if we remember one important thing. It's okay to forget to act like a grown-up sometimes. And I just realized I forgot to read the passage, so I'll intersect that in just a second. See, this is what happens when Josiah leaves to go to the army and all the kids read and I get all verklempt and I get nervous. So I'm just going to interject that right now and it'll work, right? There goes me being impressive. All right, so the passage today is from Matthew, as I page through pages and pages of this. This is when I tell myself to calm down. And it's not here. If only I could do a redo. So it's from Matthew 17, verses 24 through 27. And it says, "When they reached Capernaum, the collectors of the temple tax came to Peter and said, 'Does your teacher not pay the temple tax?' He said, 'Yes, he does.' And when he came home, Jesus spoke of it first, asking, 'What do you think, Simon? From whom do kings of the earth take toll or tribute, from their children or from others?' When Peter said, 'From others,' Jesus said to him, 'Then the children are free. However, so that we do not give offense to them, go to the sea and cast a hook. Take the first fish that comes up, and when you open its mouth, you will find a coin. Take that and give it to them for you and me.'" And I picked this because, of course, it references children. And I want us to be reminded of our ability, even as adults, to be childlike. I'd like us to remember that it's okay to forget, to act childlike and not like a grown-up sometimes. We can be childlike in our appreciation of new things, in the questions we ask, our telling of stories, and our exuberant appreciation of things. And we can be childlike in what we are passionate about. Last June, I took four teens from this church to the UCC's Western Regional Youth Event in Seattle. The first night there, the Pacific Northwest Conference minister, Reverend Mike Denton, spoke to us. And he said something that struck me then and stayed with me, much like that Reader's Digest story. Reverend Denton said something that I had never thought of before, and I had certainly never heard from the pulpit. He said, "Most of Jesus' disciples were teenagers and not adults." In the words of teens today, I was mind blown. And I also didn't know if I fully believed it. All these years, whenever I had imagined the faces of Jesus' disciples, it was men that came to my mind's eye. Basically, I hear the word disciple, and I picture Da Vinci's painting, The Last Supper. The disciples were teenagers? How could that be? I believe Reverend Denton's rationale for making this statement is found in the Gospel of Matthew. The 28 chapters of Matthew tell the story of Jesus, all the way from his genealogy and birth through his ministry, and it continues through the death and his resurrection, and it ends with his sending of the remaining 11 disciples out into the world through the Great Commissioning. The first four disciples are listed in Matthew 4, in verses 18 and then 21, Simon, also called Peter, and then his brother Andrew, and then the brothers James and John. Matthew, the tax collector, is named in chapter 9, and then by chapter 10, all 12 of the disciples are named. So what do we know about these disciples? Not much. We know that Simon, known as Peter, has a mother-in-law. So he most likely was at least 18 years of age, since for the Judaic tradition at that time, 18 was the earliest that young men would marry, although they may be betrothed as early as 14. And we also know that in chapter 9, Matthew left the tax booth when Jesus said, "Follow me." We don't know, however, if he was an apprentice or not. However, it is in Matthew 17, in verses 24 through 27, that we hear Jesus tell Simon to pay the tax for himself and Jesus. By this time, the other disciples were already with them in Capernaum, but they didn't require a tax to be paid for them. If we keep in mind the Jewish law stated way back in Exodus 30, verses 14 and 15, it reads, "Each one who is registered from 20 years old and upward shall give the Lord's offering. The rich shall not give more, and the poor shall not give less than the half shekel when you bring this offering to the Lord to make atonement for your lives." Thus, if you remember that, and you put that together with the chapters in Matthew, it seems logical that perhaps Simon was at least 20 and Matthew wasn't. And neither were the rest. However, I'm not really sure it really matters how old the disciples were, except for one important thing. The young are the best at asking questions. And Jesus' ministry, in fact, his legacy, was that of questioning the status quo, of wondering why some rules weren't actually better off being broken. One of my very favorite things about Jesus is that he was a teacher. In the time of Jesus, he would have used the Socratic method, the asking of questions to test logic, to help his students, his disciples, to understand the Torah and Greek and Judaic traditions at that time. And it is that which we should be doing as well, reading texts, questioning life as we know it, testing logic. Last January, I did one thing that has majorly impacted my faith journey. I took Dr. Laura Nasrallah's Letters of Paul class through edX. In case you don't know, Dr. Nasrallah is a professor of New Testament and Early Christianity at the Harvard Divinity School. I took this course at the same time I was leading a discussion of Sue Monk Kidd's Dance of the Dissident Daughter. I led that with our Feminine Faith Formation book group. Now, the first thing Dr. Nasrallah had us do was learn more about the context that Paul was writing his letters in. We learned about the time, what the Greeks were doing then, what was the social norm, and how Jews lived in that time of antiquity. And over, she reminded us that we had to read Paul's letters in the context of his era, not our own, and only then could we draw conclusions and applications about those letters to apply to our life today. Dr. Nasrallah was also very clear that we recognize the ramification of creating a canon within a canon when we read the Bible. Because when we have favorite bits and pieces of the Bible, such as Psalms, we read what is easy or what comforts us at the expense of reading biblical passages that make us question. In other words, we need to read all of Paul's letters and not just the ones we like. It was a great class, and yet I absolutely hated it. To be honest, much of my reaction had more to do with what else was going on in my life and is no reflection on Dr. Nasrallah and her teaching and her course. Because during the day, I would read The Dance of the Dissident Daughter, and at night, I'd read Paul. It wasn't a good combination. I can't actually recommend enough The Dance of the Dissident Daughter. And it's not because it was Barb Harlan's, one of her favorites. I recommend it because it's well-written and it's very well-researched. And in it, she tackles some parts of the Bible that aren't easy, that aren't comfortable, and instead she makes us question what we know of the Bible, and to some extent, our own faith. In the fourth section of the book, titled Empowerment, Kidd wrote about something that had the same effect on me as when Reverend Denton said the disciples were teenagers. Kidd quotes the physician and Jungian psychoanalyst Dr. Esther Harding. According to Dr. Harding, in the ancient times of Jesus and Paul, the word virgin, it didn't mean the same thing as today. Instead, back then, it meant belonging to one's self. And it meant that in the psychological sense of maintaining one's own identity regardless of matrimonial status. So, considering the Judaic marriage practices of that era, which were of arranged marriages, unifying families, the importance of women maintaining their own identity of self, well, this intrigues me. If we read the Bible in that context, of stories some of which are over 3,500 years old, if we read the Bible as a collection of books that had originally encouraged women to maintain their own identity, even when they were the bartering chip that unified families, well, it begs the question, what does it mean that Jesus was born to the Virgin Mary? Perhaps in the beginning, the writers of the stories weren't trying to emphasize that she was chaste, and rather they were trying to emphasize that Mary had authority over herself, that she was perhaps just the kind of strong-willed woman who would raise a son to question everything. Perhaps the answer is as simple as deflating tires. We find biblical answers when we read carefully, we ask questions, and we keep the context of the time and the author in the forefront of our experience, and we keep it simple. When I was in high school, we had a dress code that was influenced by the fashion statements of the 1970s. It was 1987, and madras print shorts were all the fashion rage, and we desperately wanted to wear them, but the school board had put a no shorts rule in place years before, and they were not willing to repeal it. Now, madras shorts may have reached almost to our knees, but because they had the word shorts, we were not allowed to wear them, regardless of the weather. No shorts. So for 3 years, we on the student council, we had done everything we could think of to convince the board to repeal this dress code. We wrote eloquent letters. We presented research. We dressed in suits and our best dresses. We even said sir and ma'am. Nothing worked. By my senior year, we were getting angry. Why wouldn't the grown-ups listen to us? We wondered. Lots of class time was spent discussing what we felt was a very unfair situation, an unfair rule. One day, my photography teacher, Mr. Dennis Tony, he piped up from his desk where he was cropping photos. "So, what's the most drastic thing you could do to get their attention without actually breaking the law?" I have no idea what he had in mind by asking that question. Perhaps he was hoping we would do something crazy that would make the next edition of the school newspaper really interesting. It doesn't matter, though, because it was the precise question we needed to hear. What was the most drastic thing we could do? Our answer was simple. We got 30 boys to wear miniskirts every day. Because it was an open campus, 30 boys were seen by every taxpayer in my hometown who happened to drive past the high school at lunchtime. In 2 weeks, the student council was invited to speak to the school board, and the next week, we all finally got to wear our madras shorts. The young people of my school finally made a change because we did something drastic based on a question. Over and over, young people have led to big changes in our homes, our communities, our world. Long ago, 11 young men went out through the Great Commission, and they told people to forget what they'd been taught. And those teens, they changed the world. And if we let today's teens be as rebellious as those disciples, they just might do it again. More importantly, if we join them in questioning and wondering how we can make the world the best it can be for all of God's children, all of God's children, just imagine what we can do with all of our book smarts and our school of hard knocks knowledge and all of their passion and energy. So please remember to forget. Remember to forget what it means to be a grown-up, and instead find the child within you and reclaim your identity as a learner and a questioner and a wonderer. Who knows what great commission we all might embark upon then. Amen.
Please stand as you are able to sing the song of response, "Creator God, We Sing."